takes apart one episode of the BBC's interminable May Day podcast series, which seeks to exculpate the late James Lemessurier, founder of White Helmets, to demonstrate the complete and utter sham the program is from start to finish. And then we got another one here who says, I've been intermittently hate listening to it. Absolutely awful, outright propaganda. That despicable person who made it tries to play the victim, presenting independent journalists on par with those with state corporate media platforms whose lies are never challenged.
Robert in Lakesh with those stories. Robert, thank you. And that's your broadcast. Goodbye from me and the team here in London.
You. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
French President Emmanuel Macron's government is pushing a new security bill that makes it illegal to publish images of police officers with intent to cause them harm, amid other measures. Critics fear the new law could hurt press freedoms and make it more difficult for all citizens to report on police brutality. The draft bill, still being debated in the French Parliament, has prompted protests across the country called by press freedom advocates and civil rights campaigners. Tens of thousands of people marched recently in Paris to reject the measure, including families and friends of people killed by police. Sihama Asbagh, an anti-racist activist, told the Associated Press, "For decades, descendants of post-colonial immigration and residents in populous neighborhoods have denounced police brutality." She said, "Videos by the public have helped to show a wider audience that there is a systemic problem with French police forces who are abusing, punching, beating, mutilating and killing people." Activists say the bill may have an even greater impact on people other than journalists, especially those of immigrant origin, living in neighborhoods where relationships with police officers have long been tense. They argue images posted online have been key to denouncing cases of police officers' misconduct and racism in recent years. We have prepared for you an article from the Associated Press news agency under the heading "Uproar in France over proposed limits on filming police." Please stay with us for more of the Associated Press article. French activists fear that a proposed new security law will deprive them of a potent weapon against abuse. Cell phone videos of police activity, threatening their efforts to document possible cases of police brutality, especially in impoverished immigrant neighborhoods. French President Emmanuel Macron's government is pushing a new security bill that makes it illegal to publish images of police officers with intent to cause them harm, amid other measures. Critics fear the new law could hurt press freedoms and make it more difficult for all French citizens to report on police brutality. Michel Zecler, a black music producer who was beaten up recently by several police officers, said, "I was lucky enough to have videos that protect me." Videos first published recently by French website Loopsider have been seen by over 14 million viewers, resulting in widespread outrage over police actions. Two of the police officers are in jail while they are being investigated. Two others are also under investigation and are out on bail. The draft bill, still being debated in the French Parliament, has prompted protesters across the country called by press freedom advocates and civil rights campaigners. Tens of thousands of people marched recently in Paris to reject the measure, including families and friends of people killed by police officers. Sahama Asbagh, an anti-racism activist, told the Associated Press, "For decades, descendants of post-colonial immigration and residents in populous neighborhoods have denounced police brutality." She said videos by the public have helped to show a wider audience that there is a systemic problem with French police forces who are abusing, punching, beating, mutilating, and killing individuals. Activists say the bill may have an even greater impact on people other than journalists, especially those of immigrant origin, living in neighborhoods where relationships with the police have long been tense. They argue images posted online have been key to denouncing cases of police officers' misconduct and racism in recent years. Sihama Asbagh expressed fears that under the proposed law, those who post videos of police abuses online may be put on trial, where they could face up to a year in jail and face a €45,000 fine. She said, "I tend to believe that a young Arab man from a poor suburb who posts a video of police brutality in his neighborhood will be more at risk of being found guilty than a journalist who did a video during a protest." Amal Bentoussi's brother, Amin, was shot in the back and killed by a French police officer in 2012. The officer was sentenced to a 5-year suspended prison sentence. Along with other families of victims, in March she launched a mobile phone app called Emergency Police Violence to record abuses and bring cases to courts of law. She told the Associated Press, "Some police officers already have a sense of impunity. The only solution now is to make videos." The app has been downloaded more than 50,000 times. She added, "If we want to improve public confidence in the police force, it does not go through hiding the truth." The proposed law is partly a response to demands from police unions, who say it will provide greater protection for police officers. Abdoulaye Kanté, a black police officer with 20 years of experience in Paris and its suburbs, is both a supporter of the proposed law and strongly condemns police brutality and violence against police officers. He said, "What people don't understand is that some individuals are using videos to put the faces of our police colleagues on social media so that they are identified, so that they are threatened, or to incite hatred." He argued, The law doesn't ban journalists or citizens from filming police in action. It bans these images from being used to harm, physically or psychologically. He added, the lives of police officers are important. Jean-Michel Fauvergue, a former head of elite police forces and a lawmaker in Emmanuel Macron's party, who co-authored the bill, said in the National Assembly, a tiny fraction of the population feeds rage and hatred against police officers, adding, we need to find a solution. The French Justice Minister, Éric Dupond-Moretti, has acknowledged that the intent to harm is something that is difficult to define, and the government appears ready to back revamping part of the proposed law. Activists consider the draft law one more step in a series of security measures passed by French lawmakers to extend police powers at the expense of civil liberties in France. A statement signed by over 30 groups of families and friends of victims of police abuses said that since 2005, all security laws adopted have constantly expanded the legal field, allowing police impunity. Riots in 2005 exposed France's long-running problems between police officers and youth in public housing projects with large immigrant populations. In recent years, numerous security laws have been passed following attacks by extremists. Critics noted a hardening of police tactics during protests or while arresting individuals. Hundreds of complaints have been filed against police officers during the Yellow Vest movement. Against social injustice, which erupted in 2018 and saw weekends of violent clashes throughout France. The French Interior Minister, Gérald Darmanin, said out of 3 million police operations per year in France, some 9,500 end up on a government website that denounces abuses, which represents 0.3% of all operations. France's human rights ombudsman, Claire Hédon, is among the most prominent critics of the proposed law, which she said involves significant risks of undermining fundamental rights. She told the French Parliament, the National Assembly, our democracy is hit when the population does not trust its police officers anymore.
Around the World with Reporters.
As part of Israel's land grabbing and illegal settlement expanding policies in the occupied West Bank, Israeli media have reported that a Knesset committee member and senior Likud member Nir Barkat has presented a plan to the Knesset to further expand settlement activities in the occupied West Bank and the Jordan Valley. According to the plan, Israel needs to establish some industrial zones and expand tourism in the areas.
Nir Barakat is one of the establishment, this fanatic Zionist establishment, that they are behind this colonial project. So what he did is not, he's saying, and what he offer is not something new. It's part of the whole Zionist plan, colonial plan that's already going on the ground. When we talk this year about 15,000 housing units that has been issued, this is double than the last year.
Barkat has also announced that Israel aims to settle 2 million Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank. This comes after contacts took place between settlers and Barkat himself over the past few days. Experts say to make this available, Barakat has put a plan to tighten Israel's grip on the Palestinian lands, adding that the Israeli regime will have to approve these plans before the inauguration of the next U.S. administration on 20 January 21 to make sure they will be applied.
Israeli parties are using the remaining period of Trump administration to carry out an ethnic cleansing project, first in Jerusalem al-Quds and then in the occupied West Bank. Tel Aviv wants to restrict Palestinians in their villages and at the same time to control their surrounding areas without official declaration of annexation.
During the four-year period of U.S. President Donald Trump, settlement activity has more than doubled, as the number of plans approved by Netanyahu's regime increased 2.5 times compared to the previous 4 years. For years, Israeli authorities have continued to facilitate the expansion of illegal settlements in Palestinian territories. Tel Aviv has done everything possible to minimize the Palestinian population. Experts say what Israel is doing is annexation of Palestinian lands without official declaration. Mona Kandil in front of the Israeli settlement of Beit Il, occupied Ramallah.
The number of coronavirus infections is on the rise in Gaza. Infections have spiked to nearly 22,000 cases since March. Daily hospitalizations due to COVID-19 also continue to rise, bringing the average of serious and critical cases to more than 20% of confirmed cases. Some 2 million Palestinians in Gaza are at the increasing risk of contracting the virus amid a severely depleted healthcare system, which is largely attributable to the Israeli regime's ongoing blockade.
The growing number of infections is exerting a lot of pressure on our health system, which is already in a bad shape because of Israel's blockade. The health sector is suffering from acute shortage in medicines and equipment to combat the deadly pandemic.
Local authorities in the tiny enclave have been desperately fighting to prevent the devastating outbreak of COVID-19 since March. People in Gaza who recovered from the deadly virus are still traumatized and say they are lucky to be alive.
The coronavirus infection was a horrifying experience. As a photojournalist, I have covered Israeli wars and military bombardments, and honestly, I was much more scared when I contracted the COVID-19 virus. When facing coronavirus, you are facing an unseen enemy. Anyone can get infected, and I have seen young people fighting for their lives in intensive care units.
The pandemic has added to the substantial financial strain already felt by many families living in the Gaza Strip and left a huge negative impact on the economy.
The pandemic started to spread locally in late August, and every day we hear of hundreds of new infections. The pandemic has hurt all businesses, especially small businesses like mine. I have to work every day. And if I don't work, I will not be able to provide food for my family.
Hundreds of Gazan patients have already lost their lives in recent years due to the Israeli regime's inhumane practices.
Experts warn that the unprecedented surge in COVID-19 cases in the Gaza Strip will soon overwhelm the under-equipped health sector. The tiny enclave has been under a crippling Israeli blockade since 2007. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran's incumbent parliament has taken by far the most headline-making measure since the beginning of its tenure. 251 out of 260 lawmakers voted yes to a draft bill, dubbed the Strategic Action Plan to Lift Sanctions. The bill comprises nine articles, all authorizing the resumption of nuclear activities that have been limited under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The first and most important article requires the government to disregard the 3.67% cap that the deal has imposed on the grade of enriched uranium and resume enrichment at 20% purity level. The parliament's bill now needs the approval of the Guardian Council to become law.
My colleagues and I in parliament have tasked the government to suspend any foreign access and monitoring beyond the additional protocol within 2 months of the adoption of the law. The Islamic Republic will then continue to cooperate within the framework of the IAEA safeguard, but not the additional protocol. The government will also have to return to the 20% uranium enrichment grade needed to produce medicine for cancer patients. It will produce at least 120 kilograms of uranium with 20% enrichment annually at Fordo and store it inside the country. There are other steps all taken to revive our rights and respond to Europe's lack of commitment.
The new legislation was proposed in the wake of the assassination of top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, which Iran blames on Israel. Tel Aviv has long been openly trying to torpedo Iran's nuclear energy program. The Israeli regime was also implicated in the targeted killings of four other Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
The footprints of Israel cannot be cleared in this case. Mr. Fakhrizadeh has been the number one target of Mossad for two decades. And recently, there are reports that the weapon collected from the site of Tiris Act bears the logo and the specification of Israel military industry, and Israel has not commented on the issue yet, but it should brace for serious if for that from Iran.
Iran's change of tone toward the nuclear deal came in 2018, following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the multilateral accord. Iran has also been criticizing the European parties to the deal for failing to live up to their commitments under the deal. Last year, Tehran began a stepwise suspension of its nuclear obligations to make the EU keep its side of the bargain. This last move by Parliament is the boldest countermeasure Iran has taken to, quote, keep the balance between its obligations and rights under the accord. They say this way they will unlock the shackles placed on the country's nuclear program and pursue the goals of assassinated nuclear scientists like Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Despite working at breakneck speed, the makers of the COVID-19 vaccines, now on the verge of being rolled out, insist no corners have been cut. Biotech company Moderna has applied for U.S. and European emergency authorization for its vaccine, which it claims to be 94.1% effective with no serious safety concerns. Meanwhile, United Airlines are getting ready to kickstart a global supply and distribution network for Pfizer's vaccine. Governments everywhere are trying to secure their share to kickstart their economies.
We have every reason now to be very hopeful that these vaccines really will turn the tide in the struggle against the disease and unlock not just this country, but unlock the whole of the world and give people finally a sense of relief.
And as we set out this weekend, we've secured 2 million further doses, meaning that we in the UK now have access to a total of 357 million doses of seven different vaccines.
A mass inoculation program is expected to begin in late December, and more than 80% need to be vaccinated for the global initiative to succeed.
The challenges of mass distribution are immense. Some of those challenges are convincing people that the vaccine is necessary and safe, because this has happened before and things have gone wrong.
In 2009, a British company developed a swine flu vaccine. It was approved by the European Medicines Agency for use across the EU, but following a widespread vaccination campaign, 1,800 people, primarily children and young adults under 30, developed debilitating narcolepsy that causes excessive and often uncontrollable drowsiness. So is this happening too fast?
Apparently the MHRA, the Medicines and Health Regulatory Authority in this country, has put out a tender, which was put out through the EU. I think that's how it got picked up into the news. But this tender is for an artificial intelligence system, which they are saying is necessary to spend public money on that because there are going to be a very high level of adverse events. Now, we obviously have had vaccination in this country for a very long time, mass vaccination programs on a routine basis. So that's quite surprising because we've got all of these other vaccines with a system which copes with their adverse events. But apparently now we need an entire new standalone system because the level of adverse events expected are going to be kind of off the scale of what our existing systems can handle.
Children will not be immunised, but the British government has not ruled out making the vaccines compulsory for adults. Westminster is mulling ways to incentivise getting the jab first. People may need an immunity passport or QR code on their phone to attend football matches, the theatre and other events like the Tokyo Olympics. Qantas Airlines have already announced that proof that you've been vaccinated will be compulsory on its flights. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Iran, Cuba and Venezuela host a virtual seminar at the UN headquarters in Vienna on unilateral sanctions and their impacts in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. The three countries are under crippling US sanctions that have added extra pressure as they struggle to fight the coronavirus. Banking restrictions resulting from the sanctions are affecting the country's ability to obtain medical equipment, a point highlighted by the UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. Iran's ambassador to international organizations in Vienna, Qasem Gharibabadi, said as the world's biggest imposer of unilateral sanctions, the US should be held accountable for the consequences of its actions.
These sanctions violate human rights in the current circumstances. In our country, we also face a problem in importing medicine and medical equipment from abroad as a result of these cruel, unilateral, coercive measures and banking restrictions. Those who impose these sanctions have international responsibilities.
The Cuban ambassador said many countries are unaware of the impact that these sanctions are having on countries' healthcare systems and people's normal day-to-day lives.
As a result of this seminar, we will try to impulse all declaration in all resolution of the United Nations to include the request to the United States and the other country and the European country who impose unilateral coercive measure to lifting those measures as the Secretary General of the United Nations requests and the High Commissioner of Human Rights.
In a joint statement, representatives of 38 participating countries said unilateral coercive measures are against international law, human rights and the UN Charter.
Under the current circumstances caused by the coronavirus, they said, sanctions have made targeted countries vulnerable and need to be lifted. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
We are told that EU officials are monitoring the situation in the Middle East very closely as tensions escalate over the assassination last Friday of senior Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The 27-nation bloc's foreign policy spokesperson, Peter Stano, gave this reaction when we spoke to him via Skype.
What happened on Friday in the city of Abzaz is a criminal act and runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights on which or for which the European Union is standing for.
One EU lawmaker says Israel orchestrated the attack under false pretenses and in cahoots with the Trump administration to try and scupper Joe Biden's plans to re-engage with Iran in 2021.
People should remember that Iran has no nuclear weapons, despite for the last 25 years Israel crying wolf that they could develop one. Israel has nuclear weapons. So, I mean, which is the bigger danger to peace in the region?
Political commentators say the EU has a pattern of issuing strongly worded statements, but will once again shy away from taking any firm steps against Israel. They say the bloc has turned a blind eye to repeated international law violations perpetrated by Israel and Saudi Arabia. Apparently, this is because the EU does not want to upset the United States. But also, trade in weapons and goods to these regimes is worth billions of euro annually. The big question now is, how might Tehran respond to Fakhrizadeh's murder? And what impact could any such response have on ambitions under a Biden presidency to save the Iran nuclear deal?
Tehran has always insisted its nuclear energy program is purely peaceful. Security analysts say the Israeli regime and the very powerful Israel lobby in Washington have shown time and time again the last thing in the world they want is peace with Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran has held a funeral ceremony for its top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was assassinated near Tehran on Friday. Due to coronavirus, only senior government and military officials attended the event. Addressing the participants, Iranian Defense Minister Amir Khatami said assassinating Iranian scientists is an indication of the enemy's defeat. The defense minister vowed a crushing response to the perpetrators of the attack.
Each
Every criminal activity, every assassination or terror will be responded. The enemies must know that they will receive a crushing response and that we will act in accordance with the order of Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Iranian Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the city of Absart, east of the capital Tehran. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but he succumbed to his wounds. He had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program. This made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
History has shown that the actions of the enemies will not be left unanswered. We will take revenge. We will punish all those who ordered and those who carried out this terrorist attack.
The main perpetrators of these terrorist attacks against my father should wake up to this reality that this path will continue and his blood will make his name remain in history for good. They can do nothing.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Iranian officials have vowed a crushing response to the main perpetrators of the attack against Dr. Fakhrizadeh, saying his path will continue much more resolutely than ever before. Salman Kujiri, Tehran.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the United Nations on November 29 in 1977. The day is marked every year internationally with rallies and activities aimed at drawing attention to the struggle of the Palestinian people. This year, a protest was held in the village of Khan al-Ahmar that is under a threat again to be demolished by the Israeli military. On this day, Palestinians assured they will continue to defend their lands amid calls by the Palestine Liberation Organization to enable the Palestinians to exercise their right to self-determination and their independent state.
We are still struggling to protect our basic rights against Israeli regime violence. Meanwhile, our dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. We have come here to voice our protest against Israel's aggression. We are the real owners of these lands.
This year, however, Palestinians say they were left alone struggling the Israeli occupation and its non-stop attempts to annex more lands, mainly after some Arab states have signed normalization deals with Tel Aviv. These ties, Palestinians say, simply undermine efforts for Palestinian state. Palestinian officials stress that what they see as a symbolic international solidarity has failed to give the Palestinian people their rights, while Israel continues to occupy most of the land of historical Palestine.
Israel will not be deterred by statements of condemnation. Israel can be stopped only by popular nonviolent Palestinian struggle and boycott, divestment, sanctions against its system of apartheid. That's what we want to see. BDS, not normalization with occupation.
The UN, meanwhile, has renewed commitment to the Palestinian people. However, its Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has cautioned that the prospects for a viable two-state solution are becoming more distant, mainly with Israel's expansion of illegal settlements, a significant spike in the demolition of Palestinian homes and structures, violence, and continued militant activity. After more than 40 years since the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the UN, Palestinian rights remain usurped and the dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Venezuela's judiciary has convicted a group of former oil executives who plotted with the U.S. government against the interests of the South American country Citgo Petroleum Corporation, which is based in the United States. The judicial ruling comes at a time when Caracas is fighting to regain control of Citgo, as the company was illegally confiscated by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. CITGO's former executives were found guilty of passing secret information to American authorities in order to inflict damage on Venezuela's oil industry, a misconduct that is regarded as a major crime in Venezuela. In this scenario, officials support the judicial verdict.
The judge's decision is aimed at protecting our country's oil industry from U.S.-funded spies like ex-CITGO executives.
On the flip side, the opposition criticizes this legal case.
There is not enough evidence of conspiracy between the former executives and the U.S., so this court ruling is politically motivated.
Nonetheless, experts say the country's judiciary issued the right verdict.
The former executives are the Venezuelans who hold U.S. citizenship. That's a felony itself, in case you are the manager of a Venezuelan company.
Venezuela's judiciary has punished the former oil executives for their complicity with the U.S. Analysts say this is part of Caracas's legal actions to get back CITGO, the oil company that was illegally confiscated by Washington. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
Secondly, the Sacred Defense gave self-confidence to our nation. The confidence that you sometimes witness in a large number of our people in the arena of science and many other arenas, industry, and other such areas originates primarily from the sacred defense. During the war, a 20-plus-year-old could rally a crowd and an army behind himself with complete power and self-confidence, and he would deliver a serious blow to the enemy. Well, such things give self-confidence and assurance to the people. The sacred defense succeeded in proving that the Iranian nation would be able to pass through the morass of an imposed war with honor.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Moreover, we achieved our movement towards technological and scientific innovation during the sacred defense era. This is because we needed many things during the sacred defense, but we did not have access to them. We did not have the necessary resources, but our pious and altruistic forces thought of building and manufacturing them. For example, the late Shahid Hassan Tehrani Muqaddam launched the missile manufacturing endeavor. Once, he as well as others asked to go and pay a visit to their achievements. Well, when we went there and witnessed that they had really begun the endeavor, well, we needed missiles, but they would not give them to us. The enemy had missiles and he would strike us with them. This made our talented forces think of doing something, and they did a brilliant job. They did it in the best way possible, which has continued until the present time. So, the movement towards innovation was another blessing of it.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Gunrunners, directed by Canadian documentary filmmaker Anjali Nayar. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Tete Coffey, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Gunrunners, which is shot over a 10-year period, follows two Kenyan cattle rustlers, who are also known as warriors, Julius Urile and Robert Mutanda, who put their violent past behind them to become marathon runners as part of a government-sponsored program to disarm the conflict-heavy region. We see Urile enter international marathons, while Mutanda gets involved in the political sphere and dreams of working towards policy change. Though as we see these once notorious warriors given a chance to pursue their dreams, we realize that the road to glory is full of bumps and detours for these charismatic men. Well, first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Kenya is known as a destination for world-class marathon runners, but as we see in this documentary, it's not as glamorous as it seems to be a top athlete in that part of the world, particularly because some of them are quite literally running for their lives, running away from crime, and we see that cattle stealing, or cattle wrestling, as it's called, is quite commonplace because that's an important source of income, and this region is also engulfed in the illegal arms trade industry, which is part of a global multi-billion dollar industry. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, firstly, it's just a fascinating sort of insight into, you know, a situation that I really did not know much about. You know, I know very well that Kenya has a history of producing great runners. I didn't know about this, you know, pretty fantastic government-run program, this sort of amnesty and the disarmament idea, which is a really great one, and obviously gives a great film title then, Gunrunners. The film itself, I mean, I think it was shot over 10 years, so you can only imagine how much footage has been accumulated during that time. And I guess, as fascinating as I found the subject and the two principal characters, I felt that in a sort of 90-minute running time, you're kind of skipping big chunks. You know, so much is going on, and I didn't feel that I was getting to know the two men in the way that I would have liked. I mean, basically, I could imagine a longer film that I would have maybe, you know, it's longer, but you would have felt more in getting into the rhythm of what's going on with these people, because there's so much to say, and they go through so many changes, both of them individually, and I feel 90 minutes doesn't necessarily do justice to everything that's, you know, it's trying to encapsulate.
You're right, it is absolutely jam-packed. It touches on issues of violence, as well as the main themes of sports and running, but then also politics and corruption. There's just so much in this documentary. And Tete, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Gunrunners?
Okay, normally when I'm told about documentaries about Africa, I yawn, roll my eyes and go, oh God, not again. I tend to want to avoid them. I was very pleasantly surprised by this for two reasons. One, it was rich in context. So that whatever was going through the lives of these two, the protagonists, if you like, it was placed within context and it gave you an understanding of the environment from which they came. Secondly, I think it was done with quite a lot of sensitivity. There's little tricks he used in what you call chopping and changing. I mean, cutting from the Rift Valley, training scenes.
Which is absolutely camps, breathtaking.
Exquisite. In Kenya. Over to the skyscrapers of New York, you could see that these are two little people operating in one world, but kind of moving out into a much, much bigger world. And the third thing I really liked about it was that it looks as if these two characters are archetypes. Urile is very much the superstar, the very talented runner and so on. And his mate, Mutanda, seems to be much more the political type. So how the two characters fare was something I was always watching to see. I was impressed.
I'd like to pick apart their characters a bit later on.
Sure.
But Lee, I'd like to ask you, this documentary kind of describes itself as the American dream, but Kenyan style. It's an interesting analogy. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm always a bit puzzled by this American dream. I don't understand why, you know, one country has a monopoly on wanting to change your life for the better and improve your situation. I mean, it's a cute tagline. I think it's kind of irrelevant. The fact is, yes, they do go to New York and, you know, run marathons there, but, you know, marathon running is a world global pursuit. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to me it smacks more of marketing than any sort of reality. Why can't it be a Kenyan dream?
Saturday marks the first annual Tekla Lorupe Peace Race. Tekle Lerupe, the former marathon world record holder from the conflict region, is partnering with the government to invite cattle rustlers to trade in their weapons in exchange for amnesty and a chance to win cows and cash prizes.
We learn from this film that this amnesty program is quite inspirational. How does it transform the lives of Aurelia Mutanda, Lee?
Well, I mean, you know, until this program comes in, they are very aware that they're living a very precarious, you know, highly dangerous existence, and one that they're very clearly both uncomfortable with. You know, it does involve... they don't answer it directly, but you very much get the sense that they've been involved in deaths. And obviously they've had loved ones or friends die as well. So it's just a really unpleasant, you know, precarious existence. So this government program is really trying to give people a kind of a firmer foothold in, I guess, you know, quote unquote, the right direction. So taking them away from sort of illegal activities, illegal guns, and trying to sort of, you know, push their energies and their sort of their, you know, their outlook in a more kind of positive and, you know, peaceful direction. So that's a great thing.
And Tete, the film sheds a positive light on this amnesty program. How effective is it really, and can you talk more a bit about this?
Well, there are a couple of things which come out. For a program to work, you've got to be able to transfer skills which are being adversely used or not constructively used into something which is positive. And in the way the story pans out with these two characters, Mutanda is very much the organizer. I mean, he had 500 effectively gangsters, hoodlums, they call themselves rustlers, under his charge. So this guy's a people organizer. And of course, he's the one whose skills are now deployed in the political arena, actually getting people involved with the program, even campaigning for a parliamentary candidate. And he says he himself has parliamentary aspirations. Then Aurelia, on the other hand, is the rising star, the hugely talented individual. They said that even as a kid he was winning things at kind of at the local level. So his skills, his competitive drive, is now being, you know, applied in an arena which can actually make him money, improve the quality of his personal life, the life of his family, and so on. And it does say that a lot depends on the quality of government, the environment you provide. These talents are available in bad neighborhoods, they're available in the right postcodes. The difference is that in the right postcode or a stable environment, those talents are able to flourish because they are positively deployed. So in terms of this gun amnesty, Kenya had a problem. I think it was a blindingly inspired idea. It's one of the funniest quotes I actually picked up from this was, he said, well, the skills I need to run I need to be able to run fast to chase cattle, and I need to be run fast to escape the police. And he's doing that in the marathon.
That's exactly the point of this film, is that violence goes hand in hand with their ability to be good athletes. Yeah. And Lee, if I could ask you, an issue that is raised in this documentary is that when you have a gun, you have a sense of power. So it seems as if it's an accepted reality or part of life in Kenya.
There's an amazing quote, and to be honest, it's the thing that probably stayed with me most from this film. I think it's Mutanda who's talking. He's like, you know, if you haven't killed someone, if you haven't stolen their property, then what kind of a warrior are you? And to me, this is really then what they're actually really trying to do underlying is change the whole paradigm of what makes a warrior or actually a man. And actually, that's something that is a huge, that's not just particular to this country. It's something we probably all need to look at in, you know, different societies, the way we construct masculine identity. And it shouldn't be about trying to dominate and power and, you know, impose yourself. And I think actually they don't explore that anymore, sadly, I felt in this. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he vocalizes it shows that actually it's making him reconsider what, you know, as a warrior he should be doing. And then the fact that he goes into more sort of, you know, political and sort of socially constructive things is obviously helping that situation.
So I know you'd like to jump in, but we're just going to pause just for a second as we take a look at another clip from Gunrunners, which shows Robert Mutanda tell us about the significance of marathon running.
When I was in the bush, I used to run. That's why when I came here, I didn't find it difficult when I started to run. because I was running even 100 kilometers. You know, when the police is chasing you, also you chase the cattle. So you chase very fast. But if you chase very slowly, the police will capture you. And then you will be in a hot soup. Look outside, the people are running. Town breathes, eats, sleeps, imagines, fantasizes. The ads, one out of 10, that you can make money out of it. And one in the 50, to really make money out of it, you start really changing your life. The luck of getting a manager that supports you and brings you to races for around a 15% commission is crucial. There is a big boulevard of broken dreams here in Niger. A big one, a big, big, big one. But some people walk over the boulevard of broken dreams, still thinking they can make it.
I found both characters to be quite endearing, but I think Matanda was the more charismatic one out of the two. And we get the sense that he had a much darker past than Arile. There was a moment when he was asked how many people he's killed, and he just looks off camera and remains silent, which is quite chilling to watch. Lee, what did you make of Matanda's character compared to Arile's?
Yeah, I mean, one of the strengths of the film is that they are very different, so you have that immediate contrast. And Tete's, described it very well. Matanda's the sort of more social, political animal. He has a natural ability and affinity to kind of, draw people in. Arile is much more kind of, quieter, more sort of focused on his own sort of goals. And so that, I think, is one of the main strengths of the film, because as you follow their paths, you find that actually they diverge more than you might expect, because actually they aren't equally talented runners. So then one storyline really pursues the actual running side of it, and the other goes, I would say, into equally or maybe even more interesting avenues about, well, if you can't do that, it's not just, guns or running. Actually, if the running is not going to be your career, you can use your skills in different ways, and I think that's a very interesting.
And we see Matanda pursue politics, but then of course we learned that it seems to be a corrupt world, and it's almost he embraces it and talks about it openly. Tete, is this a reality of life in Kenya?
It's a reality of life in Kenya, and not just Kenya, a lot of African countries. It's also the reality of life over here. But it's because there's a lot more wealth, and because ordinary people's needs are taken care of on a day-to-day basis, you don't see it as starkly. But in Kenya, it's very clear. I mean, he threatens the politician that if you don't make me, minister in charge of security, which he patently won't be able to hold, he wouldn't be able to hold that position. He said he'd mobilize things against him. But what it says to me is that these individual talents kind of drawn into this prism of organization, be it the sport, be it politics, be it whatever. And it is the quality of the organization that can absolutely, enable them or absolutely destroy them.
And I want to touch quickly on the point about guns. We find out in this documentary also that there's 500,000 illegal guns in Kenya. I mean, where are they coming from and why are they there?
Well, I mean, there was a breakup of the Soviet Union, and that led to a huge kind of splurge of small arms all over the world. And, of course, these things are what are required to create kind of little lordships in all of these different countries. And it is one of the saddest statistics of African life that where there are the greatest resources, you have the greatest conflicts. So a country like the Congo, which is incredibly wealthy, has had internecine strife for near on 40 years consecutively. Of course, while that happens, the natives can't benefit from the resources in their land, but other agents do. And unfortunately, it is often foreign agents who enable these weapons to get into the hands of these people, and so that it's almost a system of divide and rule. But, of course, if you're a politician in Africa and you're accepting bribes from foreign agents to create conflict and strife in your own country, that's a decision only you can make. Nobody holds a gun to your head to do that. So it comes to issues around personal integrity and so on and so forth.
That's a really interesting point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move on just for the time being.
My name is Julius Arile from Kenya. 6 years ago, being a warrior, fighting with another people from our country. But this time now, I am an athlete, and I can run a marathon.
He really does need to make a breakthrough. And if he doesn't have it, then it's going to be harder to fulfill this kind of dream of being in New York as an elite, top elite athlete that could maybe make it in the top five.
Good morning and welcome to Prague, Czech Republic, for the 19th running of the Volkswagen Prague Marathon.
A great race started in Prague's old town square in this historic city.